Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Comp Bio Cafe. My name is Janae, and today Ijama will be one of our co-hosts, and we're excited to chat with Francesca Toison about the art of storytelling in science and the work she's doing through her organization, Science And. As a reminder, if you have questions or comments to share, please email them to podcast@blackwomencompbio.org or leave us a voicemail at 302-715-2922, and we might share your response here during the show, but we always like to ask people for comments or questions, especially as we branch out into new topics. Alrighty, so in today's episode, I believe we are highlighting one of our members, I think pretty much a long-time member at this point, Dr. Tiffany Bright. We recently discovered that Dr. Bright was the first Black woman to earn a PhD in bioinformatics in the United States, biomedical informatics. So we've been on this search. I've been on this personal search for a few weeks, but I've now engaged some other people in this. Recently, we got an email, I think it's sometime in 2022, from someone wondering if they were the first person to receive a bachelor's. Since that point, we've been able to uncover that two BWC members are probably more earlier obtainers of those degrees, but also we're just searching for anyone anywhere who was the first in this field to have gotten a degree. If you have any of this information, also please do email us. You can email the podcast or the info@email, but I'm creating a timeline for anyone in this, people of color in the field. So I think on Twitter I said Black or Native brown person anywhere ever to have gotten these degrees. So if you have this information, I would really love to know. Any thoughts from you, Ijama, about this?
Well, I think it's amazing. Also, the fact that we were able to find this information. When I was in college, I think knowing that there's a person that actually got a PhD level in biomedical informatics, I think that's like a very important achievement. Yeah, I'll be really curious to see how people, you know, take this information on for the future generations. So
yeah. And by found, we mean Melissa casually stumbling across this on LinkedIn. Like, we would have never this if Melissa wasn't on LinkedIn at the right time. It was posted by a group called Black Compute Her. So it's another similar community for Black women in computing. But interestingly, Dr. Bright now works with a Penn connection, Jason Moore, who's now at Cedars-Sinai, and they're leading a center for like computational artificial intelligence in health medicine. Those are generally the words. I don't know the exact title, but it's sometimes it's also just not enough to just see us making this history, but it's like nice to see someone in a leadership position who's actually having some say in like building curriculum and ushering in the new generation of people in this field. If you're wondering what clinical informatics is or biomedical informatics, her trajectory is probably something good to look at. We haven't talked a lot about it since we have a bias in many of us being in bioinformatics, which is a little bit of a different flavor, but definitely check that out if you're interested in like electronic health records, like NLPs for EHRs, any type of like medical side, like clinical decision making stuff. Biomedical informatics is kind of for that. All right, so we usually just like to start with a quick shout out before we head into our main conversation today. So I'm just going to briefly introduce our speaker to everyone, and then Ijama will take it away from there for a couple minutes. So, Francesca Toison, PhD, is a quantitative developmental biologist turned writer, speaker, and nonprofit founder. In 2023, she founded Science And, a nonprofit that empowers scientists through the arts based on her belief that the next big breakthroughs are going to come from diverse, creative, and authentic voices. Francesca combined her experience as an artist, community activist, and transformational leader to build a framework of skills from the visual, written, and performance arts translated to the practical needs of scientists. Her goal is simple: empower every scientist to express their unique voice so they can make the next discoveries with authenticity and joy. Learn about her vision for a more inclusive and innovative world through the art and science at scienceand.org. So welcome, Francesca.
Hi, thank you. Hey, I'm so excited to be here.
So we ask all of our guests this question to get insight into their unique perspectives in the field. So what is your relationship with CompBio?
I am really a trained developmental biologist. So my PhD was in the early patterning of the zebrafish embryo, but I really took a quantitative approach to that. And so with that, I actually collaborated with an engineering lab at Purdue. And so we did mathematical modeling of gradient formation. And so with that, we also did some large scale computational screens. And so I have, you know, a collaborative experience with CompBio and really a deep appreciation for being able to do the things in computers that you can't do by hand and how they can really complement more classical biological techniques. So that is my kind of experience with CompBio. So I have always been like a really big picture scientist of why and how and are there large scale principles. So that led me to developmental biology because that's like the beginning is the embryo. That's the first pattern that starts with everything. So I was interested in biology through high school and undergrad, and then really honed in on the embryo during my rotations. There's always been a push-pull with art and science for me. I got a minor in art history as an undergraduate. I did a semester abroad, dabbled in some painting too. But during my PhD, and I think other scientists that have some art, some fine art background, you know, it really helps you with your hands, you know, the fine motor skills that you're doing. I actually had to do some pretty technical embryo surgeries as part of my PhD. I think that is something that my specific background enabled me to do, is these super technical embryo surgeries. And, you know, there's a lot of art in the physical manipulations that we do in the lab. Then I also always loved math. And so I think it was a natural fit.
That's really interesting. You were able to find this intersection between math and also art in a really technical landscape. And so I think that kind of goes into like a little bit my next question of like, can you explain how that's the significance of creativity as it relates to both your scientific inquiry and science communication? So you could kind of talk about how you're able to how that was a technical aspect that you're able to follow through. But in your work now, scientific inquiry and science communication, how does creativity kind of pull those two together?
Absolutely. So my work now that I'm doing with Science And is really about taking the things I wish I had understood kind of during my PhD. And, you know, during your PhD, you're learning by doing. You're just kind of going through it and really figuring it out through experience. And so I think that's where your personal creativity comes in of troubleshooting the types of experiments you're doing. I also think the types of experiments I was doing and the questions I was asking were a reflection, you know, of my personal interests. Like that's what I kind of touched on and how I got into this. It was kind of a very specific, there were lots of pieces that had to be put together to be able to get this one paper out, you know? And so I think that individually, each of us sees a field or a problem a specific way. And then it's how we want to interrogate that question that's where that kind of creativity intersects with the inquiry that you're, and that's a different creativity, I think, than when you're sharing your work, you know, because when asking a scientific question, it's how do you individually see the world what's interesting to you, what stands out to you as weird or interesting, or why has no one looked at this or looked at it this way? Mm-hmm. It's really personal to you. And then when you switch to communicating your work, it is not about you at all. It's about your audience. Mm-hmm. And it's about making mm-hmm. the questions that are personal to you accessible to a broad. And so really with science and, you know, we're thinking about creativity in science and understanding all the different levels of it and then giving you skills mm-hmm. for communicating it to the broad audience. We do need mm-hmm. a framework. We don't really get taught how to do that. And it is a very specific skill. And then hopefully also through that process, you know, validating your own internal creativity to keep questions mm-hmm. you want to ask, because that's how we're going to get breakthroughs, basically.
Mm-hmm. So I think you mentioned a couple times, like, what's missing kind of from the traditional PhD curriculum. Where do you think, can you zone in for a second on what that is and how are we kind of dropping the ball? Maybe not we, but how does maybe academia drop the ball on how we are developing well-rounded science communicators?
Right. I think one thing I love about Black Women in Comp Bio as like a network is that you do focus on the hidden skills behind and all the stories behind and the personalization behind computational biology, behind the scientific field. And I think that's really right on, because there are like kind of multiple hidden curricula in PhD. Mm-hmm. And the one that I found to be the most challenging for myself was around science communication, and not just science communication to the public, but to anyone else, whether that's your PI, your lab, your committee, or conference, really moving from your own analysis to sharing it and communicating it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not taught that. You know, it's not really built mm-hmm. into any part of the coursework, and it encompasses visual, written, and oral communication, or mm-hmm. turning your data into figures. That's visual communication. Those figures will then be in papers or in talks. And you also have to be able to write about your results in a very specific way that's persuasive for grants or for papers. And you also have to be able to share it through talks. So that's the kind of the performance or oral communication part. Mm-hmm. From my experience, at least, any of the like workshops or one-off courses that focus on these skills are still super technical. It's like how to write your grant, mm-hmm. and it's like the grammar of it. So it's right. still kind of the science behind the skill. Yeah. Like so much of our training is about the science. Mm-hmm. And I think that there can be training around your process and mm-hmm. like how you mm-hmm. get there. Like I think mm-hmm. writing is a great example, because there are a few like writing seminars in graduate school, but those teach you like the structure of a paragraph.
Right.
What they don't teach you is like, how do you handle the anxiety of a blank page, mm-hmm. you know, and that there are actually processes yeah. from creative writing and creatives where like, this is a whole thing that they learn yeah. and they know how to do and hone in on. Mm-hmm. I think it's mm-hmm. really the process-based things that training could benefit from, and having a framework for the different processes is, I think, what would make the career skills more accessible for a broad audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do think writing is a really great access point to having sort of a more creative framework, because I think it's something that we think about doing like after the fact or when we really need to. Whereas it's really a daily struggle. I can't say that I practice it, but it's really a daily commitment to the practice of putting something on a piece of paper, digitally or physically. So I think what I'm gathering is that you are also hoping to share a little bit of that different type of discipline, because I think we're taught, you know, like, you know, work these long hours to, well, expected to show up in a certain way to be the best technical person we're going to be, whether that's getting really good at some sort of technical skill or like doing a type of analysis for us. But how much can we create space to like push our community to embrace a different discipline of writing and communication that is part of that process? So thank you for shedding light on that. Well, I mentioned a little bit of this just now, but what do you think the role of effective communication is in nurturing a community among scientists? Because a lot of what you mentioned on the Science And website is like how we can reach certain communities and how we can empower certain communities. So what does that mean to you?
I think being able to communicate authentically in a professional setting is really key to creating a professional community, a diverse professional community. So that was something that I experienced as a challenge, was finding my professional identity and how to express, you know, who I was in a professional way. And that's really all communication. And there are a lot of choices that you can make, but we don't really get a lot of guidance through that. And I think that understanding that your unique perspective is important, you know, that that is actually what is going to make your scientific community stronger through critical thinking and, you know, diversity of thought. That's what's going to lead to a better science where people can show up as themselves. And so I think that the visual, written, and kind of performance modes of communication can really help with that. You know, that's how you show up at a poster session. That's how you show up at a conference. Even with the kind of performance skills, I even think of that as not just like stage presence when you're giving the talk, but even like, what are you wearing? You know, that was a huge thing for myself and the other women in my lab, was what do you wear to a conference that feels comfortable, professional, and authentic to you? And that's another form of communication, even if it's not like about your science, it's about you as the scientist behind the work. And your science, at least mine always did, my science always felt very personal to me.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I'm in my early career in my graduate school. And I think what really resonated with me was when you said performance, trying to also find how your own self is reflected in your science and how you share that with others. And I think in academia, I'm learning a little bit about how there's this one mode that everyone wants you to perform and be really skilled at doing. And that does not work all the time.
Totally, totally. And I don't think you're alone in that. Like I'm speaking as if like I figured it out during grad school. It's not. Like my PhD took almost 9 years. I was like quadruply burnt out by the end. And a lot of it was because I was trying to fit a certain mold of how I needed to communicate my science. And so I felt like there was like some reinventing the wheel and kind of like going in circles, because I was trying to fit what I wanted to say in a cookie cutter mold versus, you know, if I had had other frameworks to like put my voice into, I, you know, who knows, hindsight's 2020, but I think it would have made it less exhausting. Because I wasn't trying to fit something that wasn't really ever going to fit with what I was trying to say. I think that's very accurate, that there's kind of one predominant way that we're expected to fit or that we're taught, but that doesn't work for, I think, broader types of scientists from different backgrounds.
Yeah, I look at it as an under the guise of quote unquote, what is professional? I guess a follow up question to that. In what ways do you foster a supportive and inclusive environment that does encourage participants or people in the science community to express themselves freely?
Right now, you know, science, and our focus is always going to be on the science trainees, the ones doing the bench work. You know, so that's anywhere from an undergraduate to postdoc, really. And so I think first is when, so Science And gives workshops and seminars around creative skills. And our approach to the workshops is we never tell you like what to do. It's mostly principles like grounded in real skills that then an individual can express themselves through. And so I think that's a pretty different approach to teaching, is instead of, you know, saying like memorization, like this is the norm, you always have to do it. It's saying like, these are the four levers. You know, I'll give the example of graphic design. So we've made a workshop on graphic design for figures. And our approach to that is saying, here are these four levers, and these are the things that you can tweak based on your story and your goals, and kind of giving it a framework presentation instead of like a punch list, like do this and then this and this and then this. So I think that that approach in general is, it's not a protocol, you know, to be executed. It's a process for you to individualize. I think that can help people feel empowered that we care about what they want to do and they want to say. Mm-hmm. And then also through some of the other work that we're doing, we are trying to change the broader culture, or at least open, want to recognize that there's still like a power structure. And so we need to open the minds of people who are in power. And so we're also doing that by sharing some of our results. We did a survey on belonging in science. And so when we share that work in a mixed audience that has trainees as well as advisors, the advisors actually learn a lot that they hadn't thought before. Mm-hmm. And it's framed in a workshop, not a training. So it just has a lot, not called implicit bias training or anything like that. You know, I think it's just presented in a very like humanist, individualist way. And that actually goes pretty far. And then also showing data to scientists. You know, they really believe it till they see data. So sharing our survey data, I think, validates an audience and opens the minds of others.
So do you think, quick question, and then Ijama will ask, but do you think then your target audience is that mixed group of PIs and maybe trainees, or do you kind of lean toward things that are maybe more approachable and applicable by trainees? Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, we're always going to be trainee first. Mm-hmm. I think that's where the biggest gap is, especially for graduate students and postdocs. Of formalized support. So they are the guiding light. And then it kind of secondarily, it happens that our programs can affect those who are in the environment around them. And I think it is a long-term goal of Science And as a nonprofit to be an advocate for those systemic changes. But our programs are always going to focus on the trainees because they're the ones in the labs. You know, doing the discovery research, you know, making, it's how they're approaching problems that's really making an impact.
Yeah, so I'm, as a trainee, I'm just wondering, can you share like any specific experiences or particular stories where you've helped scientists enhance their creative skills? Like, is there one workshop or one experience in a workshop that sticks out of your mind?
Yeah, I think there are two. The first is our workshop on graphic design. This is called Figuring It Out. And we've started to pair it before like retreats or symposia. And so we did that at the Wistar Institute earlier this year. And that was really helpful. The trainees that attended, you know, they shared, because I ended up going to the symposium to like check, like, did this help? You know, it helped during the workshop. Did it help after the workshop? And, you know, I think that there was less of a barrier to getting your first poster started. And even if there were things that, you know, one person said they wish, like, they could change this one thing, at least they know now. And it's like they have a lot more momentum when working through their first poster for a project or the first, mm-hmm. their first slide, you know, presentation, the first talk on it, that it helped kind of grease the wheels a little bit. So you're not just kind of hitting your head against the wall. So that was pretty consistent, mm-hmm. is that the graphic design workshop just gets the ball rolling and then you know how to iterate. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure that must resonate for like computation, like you have to know where you need to improve and optimize. Just saying it needs to get better doesn't help. You have to know which direction to iterate in. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, a consistent kind of experience with our graphic design workshop. And then we have another one that's a talk that I designed called Scientists as Artists. And that's really like a kind of hype talk. It's like a Friday afternoon, like just get energized and like feel connected with all the skills you do have. So instead of thinking about learning something new, it's more reflective on like you're highly skilled and you it's really, it's a validation talk kind of. And so one PhD student came up to me right after that and, you know, she's writing her dissertation, you know, and she was like feeling pretty burnt out from the week. And then, you know, it was a 4 p.m. on a Friday talk and she came up after. She was like, mm-hmm. I feel great. Like, I feel like I can, you know, I feel like I can rest this weekend and then go back to writing, you know, and that's the goal. Like that was really the goal. So that was, I think that was like my first pilot program too of this. So that's when I was like, oh, this is something, like we have something. So yeah, those are some of the audience experiences that keep me going, but like, it's like, oh, there's something here that we need to like fully develop and scale and get to a broad audience because it's helping people.
And so those were your two pilot programs. Starting from there, like, can you discuss any innovative approaches or adaptations that you've learned from your experience in doing these workshops that you've...
Yeah, I think first in how our workshops are designed, you know, the goal is to make life easier for scientists through these creative skills. But I'm a scientist, you know, I have an art background, but I'm not a design mm-hmm. expert. So we develop our workshops in partnership with the creative experts, which I think is also really different. Mm-hmm. So the mm-hmm. graphic design workshop was made in collaboration with Maylee Carling, who is a Philadelphia graphic designer. So you're getting like the real deal translated to the needs of scientists. So I think that's one mm-hmm. difference versus maybe some existing programs, is that a faculty member gets tapped to make something and they make it based off of their own personal experience and opinion. This is the difference, is having an expert in that creative skill. So that's one thing I've learned through the development process, that really works and makes it very efficient for the workshop mm-hmm. that we create. And then what I'm actually learning as we're delivering these workshops, because we're still in the early phases, you know, we delivered each workshop less than 5 times. You know, Science And has only existed for like a year. So we're getting it out there. And what is interesting with the graphic design workshop is that there's so many ways to display data. And there's so many types of data. And mm-hmm. it makes sense to target the redesigns that we show in our workshop as examples to the audience. So that's when we found it most effective, is when we're able to find dense paper that was in like a high profile journal recently in the field that the audience that we're giving the two mm-hmm. studies. And those are the redesigns that I think have the most impact and are most practical. And so that's, I think, what we're working on toward the future, is how can we tailor our workshops to the science that audience is doing. Because we only have an hour, you know. We'd love more time, but I think as kind of a new organization, it's hard for us to say like, hey, we'll have like 2.5 hours. We really only get let in for like an hour. So we want to make the most of that hour for the audience.
I think that's, you brought up some really important points about data. I think a lot of people in our fields, the computational people listening, of course, are well acquainted with what that looks like, with the life cycle of data, with data storytelling, some might call it. But I think we don't talk enough about specific approaches that we can take in the field. So I'm hoping that we'll also be able to take advantage of some of your workshops soon and be able to have that conversation with people who may not have had their hand as much in the data generation, but could be taking specific approaches and thinking of how to tell their data story in a new way that makes sense for also the science and the biology. I think what's really important is how you are thinking about the audience and the work that they're doing, because we don't just have teams of developmental biologists or, you know, just like one type of scientist. We should be thinking of how to do this and move it forward interdisciplinarily and sustainably. So I really appreciate all the work that you have put in up until this point into turning such a really great idea into a community and an organization that is able to give some actionable steps to different people.
And I will say too, I love like your emphasis on interdisciplinary work. That's the future. It's the reality of science. And I think it's just even more of the future. And I think when we focus on process-based skills, that actually gives us a common language to talk to each other. So, you know, as a developmental biologist, I have all this background stuff in the lab of the logic of how I create certain conditions. You know, the same, I think, could be said for, you know, different computational flows that you're going through, kind of your logical framework. And so if we can have the same language or back, like if we can both know that there's some big thing that we don't tell the audience that we have to make a schematic for, you know, that's a common experience across different fields. But we have to name it first to know that we even have it in common. And so that's also part of why I like focusing on the process of behind how you figure out what your story is, how you figure out how to communicate it, because that is similar. That's like a unique feature and can be a way to start collaborations, or can also be a way to guide how do you consolidate a story to a paper. We both know that we have backstories. Let's work on how are we going to visually display that, tackle those challenges.
I think you mentioned the future. One of my second to last questions is, where do you see the field of fostering scientific creativity heading in the next maybe decade or so? Maybe 5 years is enough, but where are we going in this space?
Yeah, I think in the next decade would be a good, I think that right now, I think it's considered an outsider perspective, maybe something even unexpected. When I'm pitching or bringing this up to people, it's the first time they've thought about science as a creative process or framing science training to reflect the creative process. So, but I'm not alone, you know, through starting Science And, I'm seeing a lot of individuals reach out and making connections. So I think there's a burgeoning field here. There's a real field, and it's different than STEAM, you know, which is using the arts for inquiry, using arts for communication and authenticity. So it's kind of a different direction. And I think in 10 years, there could be more of an established community around. And in like a broad kind of lifetime sense, you know, their STEM training has a lot of room for improvement. Mm. And it has a lot of room systemically and kind of locally. Mm. And where I see, I think that there is a lot of interest and potential for at the local, like institutional or departmental level, to explore and commit to this part of training as part as creativity as part of the training process. And I think that they're going to see the impact. It has immediate impact as long-term impact, and that there's a lot of potential to increase recruitment, retention, and advancement of more diverse scientists through having this complement changes. And so that's what I would like to see kind of over a lifetime, is that this becomes a more established approach to DEI and STEM.
I think that's a really powerful perspective and something that is new. And you mentioned how you like when you're explaining it to people, maybe they don't necessarily see that connection right away. So I'm wondering how maybe that plays into what it's like to be a nonprofit founder in general. You know, we have the experience of coming from the PhD, well, actually same institution, PhD, and starting a nonprofit, a 501c3. So maybe just from that, taking a step back, what has been a challenge for you there? I think with us, something I'm hearing more and more is that we're a niche, quote unquote, community. Super niche, like, you know, of course it's like nice, you know, original, people never heard of it before, but that's, I think for me, that comes, it brings its own challenges when trying to communicate impact, trying to communicate potential impact, especially to people who can support that. So what does that look like from you just as a nonprofit startup standpoint?
Yeah, I think I've heard the same. I've had that similar experience. And I think what has been interesting is, you know, I left academic science out of a certain system, but nonprofits and startups are still very much part of the same. That is, you know, it's hard as a woman of color to get heard or seen legitimately. So then I try to flip it like, well, I'm prepared for that. You know, I think that is a challenge that I wasn't anticipating as much is, you know, having to be really selective in what communities I'm pitching to. So I really go for who is going to understand my base level assumptions, like need, you know, more diverse scientists. We need an intersectional approach to science. And so I've started just really only speaking to audiences that are not audiences, but partners or mentors are really going in that kind of business development sense to people who understand that. And that's actually can be a strong filter of who thinks that is a financially viable or even worthy thing to do.
So I think that can be a whole other episode of what that process is like, getting people to trust you. It sometimes it doesn't come in even in just monetary support, but just like how to get people on your team to understand an idea. Obviously, you know, we come from a science background. We don't have the business aspect, and literally nonprofit startup has just been learning as we go.
I think there's a lot of science of that, of like I feel comfortable. I think that's something that we maybe underappreciate of our scientific is that you get comfortable, especially by the end, I think, of your PhD, you get really comfortable with uncertainty and big problems that you have to like chip away at in like different directions and then iterate on, which I don't think everyone is as comfortable with that. So that's something that I think scientists can bring to whatever field they're in, is kind of this robustness to failure, not even failure, but to robustness to challenges and
rigidity, bureaucracy.
Absolutely. And I will, one final thing to say too, is I found that like when I share my idea, there are some people who don't understand, but there's also a fair amount who are like, oh, we'd never thought of it this way, but that makes total sense. Mm-hmm. I think that's the part mm-hmm. that it's like, oh, this is a gap or a niche that no one's thought to look in before. And, you know, I think the thing mm-hmm. about like niches, even if you think in like stem cell terms, is you might think of highly mm-hmm. specific, but they can actually like expand and affect a lot of other things. So just someone's mm-hmm. looked at it and it looks hyper specific, you know, mm-hmm. stem cell niches make everything, you know, niche is not necessarily a mm-hmm. bad thing. Impact yeah. that it can have. So that's what I take to heart, is when you kind of blow someone's mind with your idea, like, oh, mm-hmm. we've never thought of the world that way before. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the party.
That was beautiful. Yeah. That was awesome. Thank you for that perspective.
Thank you so much, Francesca, for that thought, sharing your work, and also how important it is to not only think about how we communicate our science, but also the way or the processes we do in order to communicate our science. Also, thank you so much for our audience for listening in to our Comp Bio Cafe mm-hmm. episode. Woohoo! If you have any questions you'd like answered on the podcast, please send us an email at podcast@blackwomencompbio.org or leave a voicemail at 1-302-715-BWCB. That's 1-302-715-BWCB-2922. And Francesca, are you willing to share where people can find you, social media, your organization?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You can learn more about Science And at scienceand.org. You can sign up for our newsletter there. And even if you're interested in requesting a workshop for your program, for your lab, or your place of work, very flexible. A startup, mm-hmm. so we can kind of meet your own specific needs. And then on Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter, we're at scienceand.org. Twitter has no posts, but it will later.
And I just want to say, I didn't get to say it earlier, but I had the chance to attend your Figuring Out workshop. And I just want to let the audience know that it was one of the most engaging workshops I've participated in. You know, sometimes I struggle to pay attention. But this was definitely a time where I felt like every slide, every piece of information was super informative and helpful. And it was just really engaging. I felt really participant. I felt like I was participating in the discussion that was coming from it. So definitely want to vouch for that one. If y'all are looking for an experience for a group of people to dive into this information, just want to give that thought.
I'm glad. That's how we want you to feel. We want you to feel respected yeah. as an audience. Mm-hmm. So that you enjoyed
mm-hmm.
that today.
Yeah. Alrighty. Well, we're going to sign off now. I'm Janae.
And I'm Ijama. Okay. See you guys in the next episode.
Yay!
The Comp Bio Cafe podcast is brought to you by Ijama Miramiku, Melissa Minto, and Janae Adams. Learn more about us at blackwomencompbio.org and also tap into ways that you can become a member or a supporter today. Thank you for listening.